Welcome to the Online Recovery Area Celebrate Around the World 2026 event. Next up from South Africa and Mexico, it is with much love and gratitude that the group welcomes Kwezi and Ella N to come and share with us. Kwezi, over to you.
My name is Crazy. I'm an addict. Thank you so much for inviting me to be of service. My sobriety date is the 1st of September 2015. I've got a sponsor. I see him every Sunday. Every Sunday at 9:30 a.m. or 9 a.m. I've got sponsees. I once heard in a meeting, they said, we don't do service so others can stay sober. We do service so we can stay sober. I know in the history of AA that there was a time when Bill W., one of the founders, oops, I'm gonna keep making a mistake, guys. There was a time when Bill W., one of the founders, he was going to hospital after he'd sobered up and got his spiritual experience. He was going to different hospitals trying to sober up people, and he'd go and he'd carry the message, and these guys just wouldn't sober up. And he was a bit despondent 6 months later, and he said to his wife, Lois, these guys are not getting it. Like, I don't know what's wrong. And Lois said, but don't you see the miracle, Bill? You staying sober. So by him carrying the message, he stayed sober. That's why I love service so much. So I fell in love with service when I went to a service workshop. I used to live in Cape Town. Now I'm based in Johannesburg. And I went to the service workshop, and an old timer got on stage and he said, I don't do service so others can stay sober. I do service so I can stay sober. And I thought, yo, that is the most arrogant of it thing I've ever heard. I love it. I'm gonna go for it. So I've been doing service for a long time in recovery. So I've got two sponsees. I stay in rehabs a lot. I used to be the chairperson for correctional facilities, so it would take meetings to different prisons in South Africa. One of them is Paulsmoor Prison, one of the most notorious and scariest places on earth. I remember before starting to do meetings in Paulsmoor Prison, they took me on a tour of the building. And I've never felt like such a dark and heavy energy. He took me on a tour of this place, and I left afterwards. And I remember calling my sponsor and I said, Jim, I don't think I can do this. You know, that place is scary. And Jim said to me, you know what, Quizzy? Even in the darkest of places, your light will shine. So I did it. I used to do service and go to Portsmouth Prison. And I had an alternate who used to do service with me. He was a bit of an older man. I think he was religious or he was a pastor, but he was also in recovery. So he used to wear like a, I think it's a rosary, but a cross. And every time we'd walk in Portsmouth, they'd open the steel gates. And I think he was scared like me. So he'd put his hand in his shirt and he'd grab his cross and he'd tap it on his heart three times. And I'd be looking in the corner of my eye, him doing this. And inside I'd be like, you better tap that cross, my brother. We are about to go into hell. But we made it, you know, we made it. We carried the message of AA, you know, and the message of recovery. And they say this is a language of the heart, you know. You know, guys, I remember the first meeting I went to in Malmesbury Prison. This is the other one now. So I get there, I've got my blue tablecloth, I've got my candle, I've got my big book. So I get there, the warden takes me through the place and he puts me into a room. And he says to me, Quizzy, when you finish, you let us know. And then he leaves. I turn around and there's like 20 inmates just looking at me. And I'm like, oh, flip. I didn't realize I have to stand alone with these guys. And I remember I just put my tablecloth there. I put my candle. I put my big book. And I open the meeting. And there's a line in South Africa we use where when we light a candle, we say, the lighting of this candle symbolizes coming out of the darkness of alcoholism into the light of recovery. And I swear, guys, when I said that line, I just felt the peace of God in that room. And I used to go and share every Thursday. And then the next week on Wednesday, I'd go to Portsmouth and fortnightly I'd do it like that. And the inmates would just look at me and say nothing. And I just keep going back and I'd be like, why don't these guys say anything? And then by the fourth meeting, the guys start opening up and sharing, you know. Most of them were drunk or they were high when they committed the crimes. Most of them were blacked out, you know. And what that really helped me with, guys, is that when I walked into the rooms, when they said we end up in three places, jails, institutions, and death, I genuinely thought it's a shock tactic. You guys are trying to scare me to sobriety. Until I came back into these rooms and I actually worked this program and I did service, and I realized most of the people in jail really were drunk or they were high. You know, the scariest story was when I went to Portsmouth Prison, the scary prison I told you about, and a guy walked in, tall guy, tattoos all over the face. When he walked in the room, I lifted my head and I was like, yo, this is the day they're gonna gouge my eye out for sure. And he walks in, and we're carrying the meeting, and we're carrying the meeting, and this guy's quiet, and then he shares at the end and he says, you know what, Quizzy? I'm in prison for about 8 years now. I still don't remember what happened on the night that made me end up here. I remember I was binge drinking with my girlfriend, and we started drinking on a Thursday, Saturday, Sunday in the AMs. I wake up in the middle of the night. I can't feel where my partner is. And the next minute I say, I hear her moaning on the floor. And then I say, come get on the bed. And she's like, no, I can't get up. Apparently, in his drunken haze, he snapped her neck. She passed away a year later, right? But he said, till this day, I don't remember that night, a blackout. And that's how I used to get hammered, guys. You know, if I pick up a drink on Thursday, I can't stop. When I start, I can't stop. When I walked into the rooms, and people would say, when I start, I can't stop. And when I stop, I can't stay stopped. I'd be like, don't you have a job to go to? That's how arrogant I was. You know, they say when you come into these rooms, listen to the similarities, not the differences. I used to come in here and just hear the differences only and be like, no, I'm not like you guys. I refuse to be like you guys. You know, chapter three of the big book, More About Alcoholism, it says that the one thing we drink to the gates of death or whatever, trying to prove that we can be normal drinkers or normal users. That was me trying my best, trying my best. I'm never gonna end up here, you know. But now I understand when they say once I start, I can't stop, and when I stop, I can't stay stopped. They mean that when I have that first drink, all bets are off. If I promise my grandmother I'm gonna fetch her, not fetching my grandmother. If I promise you guys I'm gonna come share this meeting today, not gonna come share this meeting. If I promise my sister I'm gonna take her to church, not gonna take her to church. Those are the promises I used to make to people, and I'd never show up. You know, my sister's never had a drink in her whole life. She's like my best friend. And she used to ask one thing of me. She'd say, Quizzy, just take me to church every Sunday, you know. And I used to do it, you know, hangover, whatever, I'd show up. And there was a day I didn't show up, and she took a taxi, and she got robbed on that taxi. You know, she could have been killed and raped. But those are the stuff that I do when I pick up drugs and alcohol. And but it's not like that now. The steps in step nine, the promises, they say we'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, this new freedom and new happiness is something, it's not something I felt before, because when I was a child, I was a very fearful child. I was a people pleaser, and I thought humility was being a doormat, letting people walk all over you. I was like a feather in the wind. If the wind blew this way, I'd go that way. If Pete said we're gonna go this way, I'd go that way. If Rachel said we're going this way, I'd go that way. I stood for nothing, you know, had no backbone. I was an attention seeker because I had that hole in the soul. So I remember in primary school, I was a high achiever, not because I liked school. I don't think I ever liked school. But I just used to love being in the stage and holding a certificate and hearing those applause, because it would fill that hole in the soul that later got filled by alcohol. Growing up, I had two role models growing up. One of them was Rich Forster from The Bold and the Beautiful. I used to watch soapies when my mother was watching. And Rich Forster only had two problems every episode, whether to choose Brooke or Taylor. I was like, actually, I want to be this guy one day. And my other role model was Tupac Shakur. a rapper from the USA. Yo, I loved him because I'm a people pleaser, right? I'm scared of people. I'm scared of women. I'm scared of gents. I don't know what I stand for. But Tupac just swears at everyone. West Side, all the way. I'm like, yo, and I just get drunk and I'd be Tupac. Crazy. I'd be charismatic. I'd make people laugh. I'd be like the cool guy. But every morning I'd wake up and it's back to crazy again. This person that I don't love, this person that I don't know how to live in society. You know, the big book says we're restless, irritable, and discontent until we could feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes from the first drink. Guys, I was just discontent. Nothing was ever enough. I could have dated Beyonce, it would have never been enough. You know, restless all the time. Like I'm jittery. I can't keep still. That was me. Irritable, you know. Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink, self-pity all the way. And I used to be irritable because the big book also says lack of power. That was our dilemma. If only my mother was as nice as all the other mothers. That's how I used to feel as a child. My mother grew up in a very nice in a very rough neighborhood in Cape Town. It's called Guguletu. It's a township. So the way she raised me was very militant. You know, it was like, did you do your homework? Did you do this? Don't mess around. Don't. So I kind of felt like, man, that doesn't feel like love. And then I used to see how my friends' mothers would relate to them. They'd allow them to drink in the house. And I'd be like, yo, I wish my mother was the first person in my resentment, in my step four, the top one. And now she lives with me due to some financial constraints. She's moved into the house with me. And that's what this program does, guys. So I walked into the rooms of recovery in, well, let me finish what I started with. I've got a sponsor, I've got sponsees, I shared rehabs. I do meetings almost every day. When I got into the rooms, you guys said I must do 90 meetings in 90 days. I probably did 120 meetings in 90 days. I prayed to a higher power of my understanding, the higher power that I met in these rooms. You know, growing up as a child, they said, the God they told me about was a God that blesses you if you're good and burns you if you're bad. And I remember someone once saying, even if you think a sinful thought, you're going to hell. And I thought, yo, I'm in trouble. Because the thoughts that went through my head, the sexual stuff that I thought about, I was like, yo, no, this God is going to burn me. And then I come into AA, and step three says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Not over to the anger of God or over to the judgment of God, over to the care of God. I've got a caring higher power, magic. Like that's beautiful. That's a higher power I met in these rooms. You know, I always say there's two game-changing moments in this program for me. It's when Abby Thatcher went to Bill W and said, and it came to carry the message. And then he mentioned the word God, and Bill was like, oh, you are religious nutcase now after getting drunk with me. And then AB said, no, Bill, find a higher power of your own concept. Like that's powerful. I remember doing a step two with my first sponsor, and we were doing step two, and he said, list all the moments in your life that had divine intervention that you can't explain with your naked eye, right? Because step two says, came to believe a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. And I wrote all these beautiful things, like stuff that happened in my childhood, where God, like it could only have been God. And then another thing I was asked to do in step two was, if I had to hear a knock on the door right now and I had to go open the door, and there my higher power was standing, what qualities would my higher power have? And I wrote, my higher power would be loving, would be caring, would be all-seeing, you know, because sometimes I get angry when I don't get something I want. You know, I used to go for interviews. I work for an alcohol company, so I used to go for interviews in order to get a promotion, and I'd get rejected. But because I did a step two, I didn't have to drink for that. Because if my higher power is all seeing, it means that God is seeing something that I can't see. I'm being protected from something I don't know. And then, guys, the year I got a promotion at work in 2019 and I moved to Joburg, I had the best manager in the world, like great guy, really like just protective, quizzy, learn, like not exposing me to the corporate politics. The guy beneath him, Nick, also just a great, two great people. And that's what God does for me, right? To make sure that my foundation is right. So I'm grateful to have met a higher power that cares in recovery. So I walked into the rooms in 2012. I had lost a job. I'd lost the love of my life, my ex-girlfriend, who I hurt. You know, the ABCs in chapter five, they say A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. When I met this girl, it was in 2010 or 11. I'd been arrested for drinking and driving the year before. And my case was on the 18th of June. We've got a public holiday or bank holiday in South Africa on the 16th of June called Youth Day. So I'm a binge drinker and a binge user. If I pick up on Thursday, I just drink the whole way and I forget the world. So that's what happened. And then when I had to go to court, I missed my court date on the 18th of June and I didn't know the law and I thought the police are looking for me. So I called my dad, who lived in a small town around South Africa, and I said, "Dad, I miss you. Can I come see you?" He said, "For sure, come see me." I didn't miss my dad. I was just running away from the cops. You know, I didn't know if like you miss a court date, you get arrested. So I went to go stay with my dad for about 6 months in a small town. It's like a beach town. And then after 6 months of hiding, I thought, okay, maybe they're not looking for me. There's worse criminals out there. So I went back to Cape Town and I met this girl, you know, and I thought, because those ABCs say A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I thought this girl was going to relieve my alcoholism and my addiction. She was smart, she was beautiful, but I really hurt her, you know, and I deserted her. She's the only person in my step nine amends that I couldn't make amends to because she didn't want to. But today, when I look in hindsight, you know, step nine says we made direct amends, except when to do so would injure them or others. Because of the trauma that I put her through, you know, the cheating, I also deserted her. We were quite young and she fell pregnant. So we planned to go have an abortion. And I got drunk the night before we had to go. And we got to the place where they do this thing where they give you this pill. And I was so drunk. And there were people protesting outside. So she kicked me out. She was like, "You're being a nuisance, leave here." And then I got outside and people were protesting. Then I also was protesting, but I was there for the procedure. That's how clumsy I get when I'm drunk. And then I remember we left. And then I went to the car, passed out in the car, and she left and she was knocking in the window for like 30 minutes, 40 minutes. It was hot that day. And then I woke up and I went to go drop her at a res where she was studying. And then she sat on the bed and she said, "Kwesi, please don't leave me." Tears flowing down her face. And I said, "I have to go." You know what? You know what? When I look back to that line now, when I said I have to go, what I meant is I have to go drink. Because I started drinking on Friday already or Thursday and using drugs. I couldn't just stay for a day and care for this woman, you know, painful things that I've done to people. So when I walked into AA, it was 2012. She'd broken up with me because she found an SMS on my phone, me SMSing another girl. I lost my job that year. And then I got arrested for drinking and driving a second time that year. It was on the 9th of August, 2012. The following weekend, on the 17th of August, I got into a car accident. That's why I've got the scar on my forehead. And you know, one thing about us is that we're not dumb people. Sometimes we're just too smart for our own good. So now I've got a bandage over my forehead. My mother flies from Joburg to Cape Town because that's where I lived. Because now she has to take me to the police station to go give a statement. So my mother's looking at me. I've got a bandage over my forehead. And she says, "Kwesi, surely you believe you've got a problem now." She'd been on my case for years, guys, that I've got a problem. And the one thing I thought is the dumbest thing I could say right now, I don't have a job. I look thin. I've got a bandage over my forehead. The dumbest thing I could say is, "No, mom, I don't have a problem." So just to get it out of my face, I said, "Yes, mom, I think I've got a problem." And then she said, "What are you going to do about it?" I said, "I'll go to AA." But I wasn't going for me. I was just going to get it off my back. Around the same time, I went for my first interview at this alcohol company I'm talking about. I didn't know about AA, but I knew about church. So I'd go to church and I'd pray and I'd say, God, if you get me this job, we are going to defeat the enemy in his home ground. The enemy was alcohol. The home ground was the company. And I got the job. Great company, you know. And it comes with a card, comes with a petrol card, everything. So I got that job and I went to my first meeting in 2012. I walked into that room and the first thing I looked around and it was loud. It was a lot of people and they were clapping. Who's got one day sober? Clap, 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 clap. Who's got two? And I was like, yo, these people are so loud. But I remember the one thing. I couldn't smell any alcohol in the air. And I remember you guys said, well, I don't remember the steps on the wall. I remember the hugs. I remember the love. And you guys said, we'll love you until you learn to love yourself. I was like, okay, there's something special about this place. But I wasn't ready yet, right? I looked around the room and I only saw white people. And all that crossed my mind was, I'm probably going to be the first black alcoholic in the history of AA. Then I got excited. I was like, okay, I'm going to be famous. I'm gonna do big things now. But that didn't work out. There's a couple of people of color in South Africa that are sober, more years than me. But that's how screwed my mind is. You know, I'm supposed to be here for sobriety. I'm thinking about fame. And guys, so I was in and out of the rooms. You know, once you put your foot in the rooms, your drinking never becomes the same again, or you're using. But I always used to come for the wrong reasons. So I'd come to the rooms, I'd sober up, and I'd be like, okay, I'm going to write a book now, and I'm going to be on Oprah, get drunk again. Okay, I'm sober now. I'm going to go to the gym and get a six-pack, get drunk again. Because that's not why we come here, you know? So I did that in and out of the rooms for about 3 years. I came back to AA in 2015. And what was different this time is that I looked in the mirror, and all I saw was an alcoholic. There was nothing special or different about me. I remember this deep-seated fear. You know, there's a part in the big book that says there will come a time in an alcoholic's life where they won't see life with alcohol, they won't see life without alcohol. They'll be at the jumping-off place. And I was there, guys. My sobriety date is the 1st of September. Leading up to that day, I remember crying at night, begging God, like and just asking God, please kill me, because I couldn't see life with alcohol. I wasn't getting drunk and being Reach Forrester anymore or Tupac Shakur. I was being drunk and just being a loser, a lousy loser. But I also can't see life without alcohol because what happens is that when I put the drink down, I go back to childhood crazy, that scared little boy who doesn't know what to do in life. So I remember crying that night and begging God to kill me. And by God's grace, I did it. Nothing happened and I didn't have the balls to kill myself. I met a guy because I was scared of going to the rooms. You know, they say the rooms are the last house on the block. But because I'd never achieved sobriety, I thought, what if it doesn't work? I was so afraid, guys, and that fear was so important for me. So I met a guy called Lee for coffee. And I said, Lee, I want to go back to the rooms, but I'm afraid. And he told me two things. He said, Kwesi, recovery is for people who want it, not for people who need it. A lot of people need this. You need to want this program. And the second thing he said to me, he said, Kwesi, you need to find a higher power of your own understanding. And then after meeting him for coffee, I woke up on the 1st of September 2015 and I made the shortest prayer of my life. I said, God, if you are out there, please help me. Guys, I used to have long prayers. God, I hope I didn't catch AIDS from sleep because I used to get drunk and sleep around. God, I hope I didn't get AIDS from sleeping with that girl. I swear I'll stop drinking if I test negative. God, if you bail me out of this prison cell, I'll swear. I used to have long prayers, guys, because I was living like a debaucherous life. But that morning, nothing else mattered. I said, God, if you are out there, please help me stay sober. And I got up. It felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. I can't describe that feeling. That day, I took a walk to work, and there's a beautiful stream in Newlands, in Cape Town, where I work. And I walked along that stream. I felt lighter. Something felt like it shifted. I didn't know what it was. But I couldn't rest on my laurels. I couldn't rest on that feeling. And I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. In that 90 meetings in 90 days, I found a sponsor and I used to meet my sponsor every Sunday and we'd go through the steps. I did service. I started by washing coffee cups. From washing coffee cups, I was given the keys to be the housekeeper. From being the housekeeper, I became a librarian, you know. And I used to obsess about my circle because I used to have to set up chairs. So I'd get there early to set up my chairs. And then other people would arrive, other addicts would arrive. and then help me with my circle, but then mess up my circle, then make it look like an oval instead of a circle. So I'd arrive 30 minutes earlier the next week because I'm obsessive about getting stuff perfect. So I'd make my circle perfect, you know. But that's what I obsessed about. And then I got to 18 months sober. They said, "Crazy, you can start sharing at rehab." So I used to go shared rehabs. I did all 12 steps. When I walked into the rooms, I didn't want to do the steps. I looked at steps 1 to 3 and I thought, I don't need to do the steps. I know who God is. God is going to bless me now because I'm sober. I looked at step 4. I was a very self-righteous person. As much as I was living, they say, yeah, our secrets make us sick. So as much as I was living a shady life, I always felt like self-righteous, like I'm better than other people. So I said, I don't need to do step 4. Because I don't need to do a moral inventory. The only step I was afraid of was step 5, because step 5 is really direct. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. I don't mind going to God alone and saying, "Yo, I did some shady stuff. Please forgive me," but I can't tell someone else. So that was the step I feared the most. And the only step I wanted to do when I got into these rooms was step 9. I wanted to make amends to that ex-girlfriend I told you about so she could take me back. But when I got back in 2015, guys, it wasn't about that. I did the steps simultaneously, one step after another. I think I took 14 months of doing the steps because I did them thorough, you know. And I did a proper step 4, wrote all my resentments. My mother was first, my ex-girlfriend, all of these people. I did a proper fear inventory. I did a proper sex inventory, you know. Then I got to step 5, did my step 5, and my sponsor was like, "Okay, cool. Let's go to the next step." I said, "Richard, I didn't tell you everything, man. Can we do this again?" And I told him everything, all the childhood traumas that I experienced as a kid, abusive, sexual, everything. Just gave it to him because all I didn't want to do is pick up a drink, and he didn't judge me. The most beautiful thing about step 5 is like I felt grounded afterwards. You know, I always felt like I'm better than other humans. But after doing step 5, I could become a human amongst humans. I could look at people in the eye. I could love other people. I could accept being loved. Yes, it's beautiful, man. Did a step 5. The day I did a step 5, when I walked out the building, the sky has never looked that blue. It was so bright and beautiful. The leaves were beautiful. And did a step 9, you know, worked this program. So what's my recovery like today, guys? My biggest defect of character that I've struggled with over the years is lust, you know, just loved women. I was sober and women thought I'm cute because I'm sober, because now my eyes are clear, you know, I look good. And it's been a struggle, you know. I didn't pick up a drink. But I really struggled, like dating multiple people at the same time, cheating on partners in recovery. But they say here, keep coming back. And they say here, progress, not perfection. And they say here, live and let live. Trust God, keep praying. And it's become much better, guys. I got engaged about a month ago to a very special lady. She's super religious, but she learns a lot from me. She's like, "I learn a lot from you, recovery people," because they say, what I heard in the rooms is that religion is for people who are scared of going to hell. Spirituality is for people who've been in hell and don't want to go back. And that's us, right? That's me, guys. Hell is being arrested for drinking and driving. Hell is blackouts, waking up in the middle of the night, not knowing what happened, sweating and fearful. Hell is going to test multiple times for HIV and AIDS because I keep getting drunk and sleeping around. I know what hell looks like. Hell is that loneliness that's described in the big book. I don't want to go back there, you know. I'd rather live in the light. I'd rather live with in here with all 39 of you, because I finally found my tribe, you know, people who said, "We'll love you until you learn to love yourself." You guys asked one thing of me. You said, "Crazy, just be honest with us." And I always thought I'm a weirdo and I'm awkward, right? So for someone to say, "Be honest with me," I was like, "Yo, they're probably gonna judge me." And I'd share and I'd keep sharing, and you guys would just laugh and hug me and say, "Keep coming back." And so just keep coming back, brother. And I kept coming back, guys. And my first sponsor used to say, the beautiful thing about this program is that we get 2 lifetimes in one. I don't do the steps, guys, and go back to what I was as a child because I was scared. I do the steps and I get a brand new life where I can go into a room full of people, and what other people think of me is none of my business. I'm at peace. I know what love is. You know, as a child, Life was so hard because I wasn't given the manual of life. So when I was told as a child of you die and go to a place with gold streets and milk and honey, I thought maybe that's a better place. So I've always thought dying is better than being here, even before drinking. But then I got into recovery and I did the steps. And guys, I got to experience a bit of heaven on earth, genuinely, no lies, you know, like what I felt through this program is beyond words, it's beyond imagination, it's beyond what I ever asked for or prayed for. It's just it's a glorious adventure, and I'm super grateful for everyone who carried the message so I could find it one day. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kwesi, for that beautiful message. Ella, on to you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ella. I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you, Purdy. Thank you to everyone who organized this event. It's such a privilege to get to serve here and to share my story of recovery. Over 3 years ago now, a little over 3 years ago, I decided I was going to be an agent for the business I believe is the most important business happening in our world. The business of the destruction of ego. And I took it on like a real with all the seriousness that it needed after I failed quite a few times the first few months. No, I was eager to get it ongoing, but it wouldn't work out because why wouldn't it work out? Because of the fear that was instilled in me. And this fear made me cocky too, because I also was so self-reliant. This was the problem. It says in the book, self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. And instead, it made it worse. No, and it made us cocky. It was worse. And I still struggled with that situation because I thought I had so many convictions and moral. Everyone was wrong in the world, you know? Everyone was wrong. A lot of the people that surrounded me did not have moral convictions that I had, did not know what I knew. And just like it was shared earlier by Kwezi, which is such a wonderful share. It was so inspiring. Yes, it made me very alone. So this is also a great testament for me to share with you that getting sober online and getting recovered online is possible because I was so alone that I'm from Mexico and I could not get sober in person. I was forced to go to rehab. And when I was in rehab, I did not relate to any of the people there, to the stories that were being shared there. I was there for 3 months, going to meetings every night, leading meetings that I didn't understand. I didn't understand the language. You know, but I was so alone that I left the rehab and I had experiences where I would connect to this solution that I only understood later that it was a spiritual solution that I could not see that was it was right there happening for me. This higher power was already acting, but I couldn't see it. So I left rehab and I started living in this apartment, an apartment that ended up being the apartment of a friend that I thought I had lost, which then I recovered there, but then I lost again because I had no solution, even though I had recovered her from years of not seeing them and being very sad that they had opened their home for me in Spain. I appeared in their old apartment and I got to see them again. And I was just like, serendipity, there's something. There's this something. And yeah, but don't speak to me about God. Don't speak to me about anything spiritual because I know about it and this is just wonderful. So I got my friend back, but then I lost her because of this self-reliance and because of fear that was beneath that fear. So I want to talk to today to you all because I know that the steps have been shared, but if you're just joining, this solution was just incredibly shocking to me that the solution was spiritual. And I was like, why are you who is what are you going to tell me about spirituality? I mean, I've been meditating since I was 11 when people didn't do that. No, I was doing yoga. I was like, you can't tell me about that. And I follow the driver's manual in Mexico. Like, you're not gonna tell me how to be moral or spiritual. But yes, I did not get the solution only until I found this group in online. It was incredible that I finally hit that gift of desperation years later after falling back into alcohol, into substances, and after rehab. I had to find something online because I could not go to meetings here. I could not relate to the people here. Most meetings were for men, and I felt in, like not comfortable sharing my story with them. And also because of this disease, that it's a disease that creates isolation, my mind worked differently. My mind, I was so alone since I was a child that I thought in English, which is like, so who's gonna tell me today that you can't be recovered, or who that there is not a God that has me helping people all over the world in English? No, just yesterday I got to meet from one of our fellows. A sponsee of mine came down to Mexico. They're from the U.S. and I got to share tea with them. It was absolutely fabulous to be in person with someone here that I've helped, that are receiving the message. There is a higher power that is actually behind this all, that is orchestrating it all. No? And what it was wonderful to learn that when I got that gift of desperation, that I was humbled enough by this higher power to just say, I'm gonna do whatever you tell me to do. No, I'm gonna do whatever you say that I need to do, and I'm gonna open up. So that was necessary, to be open enough, honest, completely honest about it all, despite the fears that were behind that, and willing to continue even when it hurt to be humbled, when it hurt to be disciplined. So now I'm experiencing something that I'd never thought I would experience, that people are listening to me, that people in my own family, no, I lost all my friends. That's the truth. I did not have connection to anyone in my city. During the pandemic, I went and lived in the US. I lost friends from the US. Because it was still me trying to drive. It was still me trying to direct everything. But today I'm getting my family back, my family of origin back, which are the most important people that I've got. And they did not want to be close to me. My siblings did not want to be in connection, especially my younger sister. She did not want to have a connection with me, even though I made an amends with her after I finished the steps here. They were like, I don't trust you anymore. I don't want to know about, like, it'll take time. It'll take time. And it took her the 3 years. Just this year is that she's been reaching out to me asking, can we connect? And now I'm experiencing that my other sister is actually asking me about this solution. It's asking me, like, what do I do when she finds herself in a situation that is difficult? She wants to know what I'm doing. What is this thing about the spirituality that you talk about? Tell me what you do, no? And how I'm learning more and more to be in connection to this higher power by not acting, by not praying out of fear. This was the one thing that was so confusing for me. Because the solution is that, is the solution is a connection with a higher power within ourselves, is a constant connection, and knowing that I'm not above that, but I'm an agent for that higher power. And that is a lot, because being a my upbringing was a Catholic, like many Mexicans, and so my understanding of a higher power was one that was punishing, that was one a higher power, a God that was unfair. But I had to learn that my ideas of that higher power, what were wrong, not the higher power. I was just limited to understand what this higher power was about. And now I can still say I don't understand it. I don't understand this higher power in full. I don't understand what God, really God is. I can just see manifestations of it. The greatest manifestation is that that I haven't had a drink. I haven't used substances since November 2022, November 4th. And when I did that, I want to tell you that story of how I came in. That this book tells us also that the way it manifests for each addict, it varies. But we do have the common things that are similar in all of us. That the common things is that we try many ways to manage, and most of us says like that we want to stop and we want to stay stopped. For me, it wasn't that I wanted to stop. I didn't have a problem. For me, is that I wanted success and I couldn't get it. I wanted success to get like to have friendships, to have it mainly. I wanted a husband and a family, and I wanted to be seen as someone that could be respected, someone that was honorable, that was, respected. That's what I wanted. No, I wanted to be admired. That wasn't really respect what I wanted. What I wanted was admiration. What I wanted was recognition. I wanted a diploma of life. No, this was what was really happening. But I didn't try to stay stopped. Like I told you, I went to rehab and I kept drinking after I left. And in the pandemic, I met up with someone and lived with them, and we were drinking most of the day. And it didn't work when my dad said, "I'll help you find this room where I found this friend." And he made me sign a contract that I would go to one meeting a week, every week, so that he would help me with the payment of that room that I was now renting, because I had lost all my money. And after the contract that year ended, I drank again. I smoked again. I used again. So contracts didn't work. Those are the common things. But for me, it was I wanted success at every cost. I didn't even want to try not to. When my relationship with that person failed and I had to go back to living with my parents, and I couldn't find a job. I wanted to stay in the US and I couldn't find a job, and I had to come back to Mexico. I was a little afraid again now, because it was like this is like a lot of people are telling me that I can't do this, that I get into trouble if I continue to do it. So I'm gonna take it easy, because I still thought I could control my drinking. I was like, I could just drink on the weekends. Like, and I did. I was just drinking on the weekends for some time. Then I found this apartment and I was like, I can handle it. But then other elements came in that really led me to my sprees, my over drinking, overusing substances, marijuana mainly, was when I liked a person that I didn't like to begin with. I didn't really like this person to begin with. And that was also like the mental like twist that I was like, why am I with this person? And I want this attention, this admiration from this man so much that I ended up drinking in a spree and using in a spree, and I was afraid of losing this apartment and losing my life, and it was going to happen again. And that's when I got my gift of desperation, and I said, I need help and I'll do whatever. So I thought my issue was codependency. I had heard of that term before, so I looked up codependent traits online, and I said, yes, I've got all of them. All of them. Check, 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 check. So I started to go online to online meetings, three online meetings a day, trying to learn the most I could. And I finally heard someone that had like something I wanted, that they seemed really free, really happy with a new life. So I asked them, can you lead me through the steps? And I used the workbook that we have in this fellowship. And I like unconsciously I would read the part of alcohol, even though I did not think I had the problem. But I re would read alcohol and then insert every other situation I thought was a problem. But the first thing I got relief from was alcohol. As soon as I finished taking the steps with my sponsor, I was afraid of drinking. I was like, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore. Doesn't feel like something that seems okay, because this God that I had opened up to, the word God I opened up to, was I was feeling that experience. So I was like, maybe it's not a great idea to have a drink anymore. Well, I did. It was my parents' anniversary, and we were sitting at this restaurant, and My dad knew that I was drinking again, and he poured some wine in my glass, and I wasn't touching it. And he asked me, "Well, aren't you gonna drink?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna say cheers, and I'm in a few minutes with you, and just to say cheers." Well, for me, the experience was that kind of experience that seems electric, that doesn't happen for everyone, but it was in a strange way. It was that I had that first sip. After taking the steps, I had not been drinking throughout my step work, and I took the first sip, and I felt like I was like my pressure dropped, and I felt sick, like I was gonna faint. My mom had to hold me, and I said, "Take, I don't feel well. I don't feel well." And she took me to a bathroom, and I knew it was a real thing, that I had really made this commitment, that I had been sincere enough to say, I'm going to trust that there's something bigger than me that can actually handle my life. I'm going to entrust this higher power with my life, with my being, my entire being. And it was hard at the beginning. I didn't really believe that I needed to sponsor a lot in the beginning. And at some point I stopped. And it was not fun. It was not pretty. No, I was spiraling, because I do like to, I do believe, I don't like to, I do believe I belong to that category of alcoholics that are manic depressive, though, that needs a whole chapter. Because for me, the emotions become so powerful that I could not handle life. And then that's when I would need to pick up a drink, to pick up a thought, no, to pick up the phone and call the wrong person. So the reliance of on God has gradually built, even though I started that way. It has been gradually building, where I become more and more confident that my existence has a purpose. This is a whole new way of existing, to know that there's a reason why I exist, and it is this disease. I mean, that to me is like incredible, that this disease is giving me a reason to live, a reason to connect with people around the world, and hear them tell me like their gratitude, and see in them the change that in their eyes when they see there's someone that's not gonna judge them, because I've been there, I've done that, and that they can trust again, that they feel some form of connection, where there's something that they open up to a new idea. No, because if it happened for me, why wouldn't it happen for anyone? No, and yes, yesterday I had that wonderful experience, and on my and day to day, like on every day, I start to feel more. This is another thing the book says. It says the feeling that the problem is gone comes very often, and now it's not like it comes often and I forget and then I want to use and drink again. No, now for me it comes often, and I'm in awe that this experience is it. This experience sober is like I've awakened to life, to what life really is, where there's no desire for drinking, there's no desire for attention from anyone, and there's a lot of learning and a lot of peace, inner peace and satisfaction with knowing that I'm being of good use to this higher power, that is of my understanding that it's limited, but that is. That really is. I'm loving my life to I owe my life to this program. I owe my life to the people that have stayed here, that created that workbook that I use to sponsor. I owe my life to God, of course, to God that helped them help me. And the connection I wanted to speak more of it with this higher power, it is that it only it takes a decision, a constant daily decision, a moment to moment decision, because in any given moment I can be pulled by doubt. So that's where I have to, that doubt is what's going to make me think that I shouldn't speak here, that I shouldn't sponsor, that I shouldn't The fear again, the fear creates doubt, that ego creates doubt. So I'm very grateful that I get to be disciplined constantly with these steps. They're instructions that don't fail if you pick them up rigorously. They really don't fail. You just need to know which ones they are. And the easiest thing is that for me is the like right now, it's that all I need is the willingness to choose willingness. That if I wake up every day saying I'm going to choose to be willing despite whatever comes, and trust that whatever comes means like, yes, sometimes things are going to happen that are not easy at all. Like real problems, like catastrophes are going to happen. I'm going to choose to trust anyway, to have the willingness to trust in this higher power that is way larger than me that I don't fully comprehend, but that does not look anymore like something punishing. That's where I think many of us got stuck. I did. It's like, how is it that I'm going to trust this when it's really like what I'm experiencing, what people around me are experiencing is a lot of suffering. No. Why would I trust that? Well, you just choose to instead, just like this is one of my favorite quotes in the book, is to cheerfully see calamity as an opportunity for this higher power to demonstrate what it can do. Now, the cheerfully is not like something that I can do very quickly, that came to me quickly, but I saw in my sponsors, because I had to, fortunately, had to get two, because one of them had a medical problem at some point. I got to see how when calamity came with when they were experiencing difficulties, they would smile. And I said, well, I haven't gotten there, but I'm gonna choose to see if I can choose smiling cheerfully when things aren't going my way. And now I'm showing that to my sister when she's going through something hard. I'm teaching her that we get to really trust, to we get to see all these experiences as opportunities to remove ourselves from that thought of like things are bad. Instead, see them as things are gonna show up. This God is gonna show up incredibly. And my relationship, so I wanna share more on this, my relationship with my higher power and how I practice this step 11, which to me is like what becomes one of the most important things, to be in constant contact with your creator, in conscious, constant contact with the creator, all sees. So to be doing that every moment to moment, like I said, it's a new habit, but it becomes like the world starts to reflect it to me. My sponsees start to reflect it to me when I share that more and more. My mother, my mother, she was the first one who said, I want to know what you're doing. I want to know what it is you're doing. Let me take a look at those steps. So she took the steps, and she's going to be leading a workshop in her community very soon, and it's just amazing for Al-Anon. So this is a program that can be like used for non-addicts, because well, when you're an Al-Anon, you're addicted to your addict. So she's doing that. No, she's gaining that courage of understanding what this higher power can do for us if we just believe in it enough. It doesn't need to be a lot. It really doesn't. And it doesn't need to be even called God, because I was so angry with the word God. It can be called whatever you want, whatever you want. To me, it was like, I'm not going to fight this word anymore. Like, why would I fight it? That's another instruction that's in the book. We ceased fighting. It says, I can't fight this anymore. I can't fight any word anymore. Just, I have to be humble enough to understand that I don't know what that word means, but I can start trusting it. I can just start trusting that maybe because I was creating this higher power that was punishing, that I was giving that idea a lot more power, and that there truly exists a higher power that is beyond my comprehension, but it is actually pure love, unconditional love. And I'm having a blast. I really hope that you all can experience the same if you're a newcomer, that you can experience this God of your understanding that exists, that is in everything. It says, the book says, God is either everything or else it is nothing. No, call it what you like, but it is. It is the air that I'm breathing. It is the fact that I woke up today. It is. It just is. God is. My sponsor always says, God is. God is. And all I want now is God. The only thing I want in my life is God. I used to want a family. I was used to want a relationship, but those things were attachments that were never going to fulfill me, because also when I had a partner, it was like I'm never satisfied. No, I have a partner, and then I want to correct this person because they're all wrong and they're the addicts and they're blah blah. I could like point out everything that was wrong in them, and then I was not unfulfilled and frustrated again because they were not giving me what I wanted. I know what I want now. I want God. That's all I want today. And that feeling that I need a partner or anything else to be satisfied is absolutely gone. That I need to be famous, like Quizzy was saying. I don't need any of the things that I thought I needed anymore. I just need to be in service. I need to continue being this agent of God and to trust that it's going to make me absolutely happy, like it has been now for, I would say, like almost, yeah, I would say the 3 years, because like a couple of months there I was still struggling. And maybe I'd take out some days where the doubt has crept up and has been a little hard, but I always get back at it with the people that tell me, that I listen to here, that remind me of what it is that we're doing, that we have jobs. We are so privileged. We're so lucky, the ones that we get to really embrace this work, to have a direction. I never imagined in my life that I would have direction in my life the way I have it now. And I'm not about to lose it for a guy, for a joint, for nothing like that. I will continue being here of service to every person that God has prepared for me, whether they're Mexican or they're from the US or from wherever they are. The world is getting smaller, people. You know, and this is the reason why we're here. There's no other explanation to me, and I have the certainty of it, that God is. And I'm now starting to laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Yes, I am finally starting to not feel like, and even, you know, I also even pity them, but I also trust that there's a higher power that has been behind it also. There's not gonna be, no one's gonna get gonna stay behind forever. That's something I know for sure. It's gonna just hurt more, or or it's gonna take a little longer, but in the end, yes, I absolutely believe in this higher power, because it shows up every second of my life now, and I trust it. And I will stop there as I need to leave for work, but I'm really happy to have had the opportunity to share with you and to be here with all of you. And I'll talk to you soon, hopefully one-on-one at some point. Thank you.